Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC is an incubator for new expressions of Jewish identity. It creates innovative Jewish learning, celebrations, and arts programs that inspire personal connections to people and ideas from across the Jewish world. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 137, God of Love. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
And our guest today in our continuing series looking at God is Shai Held, a return visitor. The first time that we had him on, we were talking about the challenges that we were going to face Jewishly with the inauguration of Donald Trump. And when we invited him to talk about that unpleasant subject, he said, he'll do it, but we have to have him on again sometime to talk about Torah. We're finally excited to make good on that commitment, and Shai is the perfect person to bring in to look at the subject of God from perhaps a bit of a more traditional lens. Shai Held is a theologian, a scholar, and an educator. He's the president, dean, and chair in Jewish thought at the Hadar Institute, where he also directs the Center for Jewish Leadership and Ideas. Shai Held has been named multiple times to lists of the most influential rabbis in America. He has rabbinical ordination from the Jewish Theological Seminary of Conservative Judaism, as well as a doctorate in religion from Harvard. Shai Held has written a number of influential books, including Abraham Joshua Heschel, The Call of Transcendence, and the two-volume The Heart of Torah, a collection of essays about the weekly Torah portion, two essays per portion. It was published by the Jewish Publication Society in 2017. He recently announced that his next book will be published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, and it's about the centrality of love in Jewish theology, spirituality, and ethics. Shai Held, welcome back to Judaism Unbound. It's so great to have you here again.
Thanks so much. Good to be here.
We had some really interesting conversations over the last few weeks with a lot of folks who have been introducing all kinds of ideas about God that perhaps are surprising to people, that's a way you could think about God. But I think that your view of what God is, who God is perhaps a little bit less surprising. You've talked about yourself as a metaphysical realist, meaning that you, as I understand it, that you think of God as a being that is out there somewhere. I would love it if you could describe that in a little bit more professional terms and help us understand who is God as you think of God.
Well, I'm glad we're starting with small, simple questions. So let me say this. As I understand God, God is the source of life, the creator of the universe, and ultimately the source of love in the universe. Now, just to be pedantic for a minute, I wouldn't describe God as a being, because if God is the source of being, God can't just be another being. God is not just a piece of furniture in the universe. God is the origin of the universe itself. So describing God as a being, I think, is unfair. And I think one of the things that I would actually point out, and I'm not sure this is the right place to begin, but I think it's a useful thing to say, is that I think very often when people no longer believe in a personal God, I find very often there's a temptation to belittle and caricature what it means to believe in a personal God, to start talking about a guy out there, a fellow in the sky, whatever it might be. Whereas I think actually, many people who believe in a personal God believe in something more complex and nuanced than that. Now, so what I would say is that I believe in a God who is personal. That is, a God who has consciousness and will, but who is not a person, right? God is not like you and me. God is vastly more loving, vastly more knowing, vastly more good than you or I could ever be. Now, the cost or the danger in holding the theology that I do is that it comes wrapped up with an enormous bundle of doubt, right? If you believe, let's say, in a kind of neo-mystical way that God and the universe are one, it's a little difficult to figure out what doubt looks like. Either I believe that God and the world are one or I don't. If you believe that ultimately the world is rooted in a source of goodness and you refuse to close your eyes to what it looks like outside or what it means to read the front page of the New York Times every day, then you're forced to wrestle with a chasm between a theological conviction, that is that the world comes from a source of good, and an empirical reality, that is a world suffused with suffering and barbarism. And so you have no choice, I think, if you're honest, but to live with immense doubt. So, you know, I like your formulation. I think you said, I like to talk about God. I would prefer to say, I like to think about God a lot. I'm always ambivalent about talking about God because I'm always tempted to change my mind before I can finish the paragraph, right? It's always a struggle for me. It's a groping for something that ultimately is unknowable, but ultimately I feel very personally I can't know. I can only grope toward it.
But can you help us understand a little bit? And I don't mean it in a caricature sort of way or in an unfair sort of way. I'm trying to understand, I guess, the different possible conceptions of God that one might have, that it makes a difference whether you have this or that conception, right? And so I think that there's the God that maybe I sort of described in the question that was that kind of people do, whether it's you or others, people do think of a being that is somewhere out there or maybe somewhere in here, but is somehow a being that is a really different, quote, person from who we are. And then on the other end, there's the non-existence of God. And somewhere closer in than that is, I think, this kind of mystical idea of God that we've been exploring. And I think that your vision of who God is or what God is somewhere in between that mystical vision and that being vision. And I guess I'm trying to understand what it is, how we should think about it, and how it kind of differs from one and the other when you're saying that it is a personal God who has a will. So that's kind of where what I'm trying to puzzle out in my own thinking about it.
I think that in many ways you can say that there are two very different theological intuitions that people who have any theological intuition at all have. One intuition is the sense that all is one. The sense that when we use the phrase in the book of Deuteronomy, Ein od milvado, there is nothing else, right? All there is God. That is a view in which God is usually impersonal. And we're talking about some way in which we are all part of some great cosmic oneness. And there's a very different intuition, which is what I'll call, for lack of a better term, the intuition of otherness. That is, that when I see you, I don't just intuit that you and I are part of one great cosmic one. I actually intuit that the closer I become with people, the more keenly aware I am that I am not you and you are not me. And the theological version of that is what I think is at the heart of biblical theology, the claim precisely that God is not the world and the world is not God. If it's helpful, you can even think of it in this way. If you go back to that phrase I just mentioned from Deuteronomy, Ein od milvado, there is none but God. In its origins, in Deuteronomy, that phrase means God is God and there is no other God but God, meaning nothing in the world is God, only God is God. By the time the Kabbalists are done with that verse, you could say it means the opposite of what originally meant. Ein od milvado means there is nothing else besides God, right? That is a complete inversion, subversion, whatever the right term might be, of the actual biblical idea. Those two intuitions are often in tension with one another. That's the gap, in a sense, between Art Green and me. Art is a teacher of mine, but the gap between us is that my primary intuition is a sense of otherness coupled with a certain kind of unity, and his intuition is about unity that ultimately overcomes otherness. Now, to move more directly to your question, you know, the way you asked it at first, it is a kind of pragmatic question, and I think, or you might even say philosophically, a pragmatist question. That is, what's the payoff of these different views? And I guess I have two very different responses to that. I remember many years ago at Hadar, the students asked me and Rabbi James Jacobson Mazels to have a public dialogue, and James is even more of a monist than Art Green, but to have a dialogue about God. And what was striking was several of them pointed out to us afterwards that in the part about God, it was like we had no shared language and had nothing in common. And then when we moved to the question of, and what does a spiritual life of serving God and loving others look like, we sounded like we were basically reading each other's notes. From a pragmatist perspective, you might say, well, then who cares? What's the payoff? To which I would say, you know, a couple of things. One is, you know, the premise of that question is in itself interesting and very much a kind of a product of our time, which is that the ultimate value of a question about metaphysics or ultimate reality is what's the payoff in the concrete? And yet some of us, I think, have a certain kind of intuition or attraction to really trying to think about, however inadequately, however ham-fistedly we're going to go about talking about it, what ultimate truth is and what ultimate reality looks like. Meaning the value of that conversation is in certain ways the search for truth. Now, all of that said, I tried to argue in my book about Heschel that Heschel had a really interesting criticism of Maimonides. And I'm going to try to say this in as accessible and clear a way as I can. Heschel, I think, believed that the kind of God you worship can't but have implications for the way you imagine what a good life looks like. And for that reason, he thought that Maimonides believing in a God who was indifferent to human suffering, unknowing, couldn't help but lead to a vision of the human being who also had no feelings and was not particularly interested in, you know, the small details of human life and the realities of human suffering. Whereas the God he believed in, which he believed was the God of the prophets, the God who hears the cries of the widow and the orphan and the oppressed, believing in that kind of God cannot but lead you to a vision of the good life where your vision of a good person, of a good life, is enormously exquisite attentiveness to human suffering. Now, is Heschel right about that? I'm not sure, but at minimum, it's a really interesting argument. And I will say that I do think one of the reasons I accentuate love so much as my central theological category, it's not only that that's how I read the Jewish canon, it's also that I'm aware of how often God is brought in to legitimate every conceivable form of hatred and brutality. And I think that actually, if we're going to worship a God who's not a God of love, we run the risk of ending up worshiping a God who essentially just serves to sanction our own most brutal impulses.
I'm really intrigued by love as a binding principle, as a core conception of God. Because when I hear that, to be frank, not with any sort of judgment, it like feels Christian to me. It's not that it is or is not. It just like when I hear folks say like God is like that sounds like something I hear from many lovely Christian friends of mine. And I come from a place and I'm often saying, you know, for me, and I'm not speaking on behalf of like the Jews, but for me, like God isn't more love than God is other attributes. But there's also this character God in scripture that does a lot of loving, but also does a lot of other things. And so I'm actually flashing to what you said about Deuteronomy, because you were talking about how, okay, so there's Eino Milvado, there is none else. And you're telling us that that's actually a way of understanding that God is separate from us, but that it's been shifted by Kabbalists. And I hear that and I'm like, it's almost irrelevant to me, to my theological view, what Deuteronomy thinks about God being connected. Like my view of what God is affected by the Torah, but I don't feel like the Torah gets a veto, to use like a Kaplan term. So I guess I'm winding two questions together, which are, A, is God just love, or how does God manifest in ways that might be more complex than love and more challenging than love? And also, when that happens in our scriptures, I mean, we can talk about all the ways that God, you know, does unloving things. When that happens in scriptures, is that the God that you're talking about? Is that the God you're relating to? Or is there some distinction that you would make there, some nuance that you would bring in?
So first of all, you know, you started by saying something I think is really interesting to name and struggle with, and it's actually where the book I'm working on now begins, which is to wrestle with the ways in which American Jews especially have historically ceded the language of love to Christianity. And I think there's a history there, and there's a lot of reasons there. One of the things I will say is that I think there's a certain historical irony there, because historians have pointed out the ways that one of Christianity's historical attacks against the Jewish tradition has been the claim that Judaism is essentially loveless in comparison with Christianity, which teaches a gospel of love. And one of the great ironies of Jewish history, I think, is that in the modern period, many Jews internalized that to the point where, with some Jews, it even became a point of pride. So you hear some people say, you know, Christianity is about love, but Judaism is about justice, or Judaism is about law, or Judaism is about I don't know, whatever, you know, you fill in the blank. I see that as historically tragic because I actually think that at bottom, it's a form of internalized anti-Judaism. Now, let's think for a minute about how deeply ingrained this is. A really formative experience I had many years ago, I was speaking to the senior class of one of the major American rabbinical schools, and I said in passing that I think a fundamental assumption of all Jewish theology is that God loves us and asks us to strive to reciprocate that love. A graduating rabbinical student cut me off and said, "Wow, you really do hang out with Christians too much." To which I responded by saying, "It's so interesting that you say that, because when I just made that statement, what I was actually thinking of is the liturgy that Jews say twice a day. Before the Shema, Jews say, Ahava Rabba Ahavtanu, with vast love have you loved us. And the first verse after the Shema is, Vavta et Adonai Elohecha, and you shall love the Lord your God. When I say God loves us and we attempt to reciprocate, all I was doing was trying to summarize the core of the daily Jewish liturgy. The fact that you associate that with Christianity is enormously telling, and it just shows the work we have cut out for us if we are committed to taking back that language. Not taking it back in the sense of taking it away, but taking it back in the sense of restoring it to its rightful place in Jewish theology. That said, now you asked, you know, a really interesting question about, you know, what about the other things in the Bible or the things that rub you the wrong way, to say it in maybe a too simplistic a way. So I want to say a couple things here. One is that I think we have to talk about love in a sophisticated way. One of the problems that many people have is when you talk about love, they immediately start thinking in extremely sentimentalized ways. Love is a sort of gushy feeling. Love is a Hallmark card. As opposed to, love is an enormously challenging relationship that has to be nurtured. Think about loving your child in a time when they're driving you crazy, as opposed to, you know, some superficial notion of love. You know, one of the things that I think a lot of American Jews, not just American Jews, a lot of modern Jews struggle with are moments of divine anger in the Hebrew Bible. And yet I have to say that as I've gotten older, while sometimes the sort of crude language there troubles me, the notion of divine anger doesn't really trouble me all that much anymore. Because if you really believe, right, you know, in your heart of hearts, in a God who cares about the fate of widows and orphans and outsiders, then you can't really talk about a God of love who's not angry. Because the world is all too often an inferno. And if God cares about the world, and if God cares about human dignity, then God cannot but be disappointed. Now, is that too anthropomorphic? Well, it depends. It depends how literally we're going to use the term anthropomorphism, and maybe we can come back to that later if that's useful for to talk about. You know, Heschel actually writes in one place in a way that, Heschel writes words that I personally have come to find very challenging, even if I'm not always sure I can embrace them. He says at one point, you know, many people encourage us to feel shame that the God of the Hebrew Bible is angry at times. But for those of us who survived what we survived in the 20th century, a God who is not angry is a God who's not worth worshiping. The God who is angry means that somewhere in the universe, the mass genocide of infants actually registered somewhere. That in a world where humanity was indifferent, the indifference was not cosmic. That somewhere, someone actually cares about the tears of the downtrodden. I choose consciously, without apology, to take texts about God's love and moral goodness and read everything else in light of them rather than the other way around. And to perhaps get to something that you kind of gesture at, Lex, in your question, I don't do that because, or certainly not only because, there's a text that tells me to do that. I do that because intuitively, I think it should be obvious that love is a greater cosmic principle than hate. And I actually think it's a sign of spiritual illness if we think the only way to get there is by finding a text that says it. That said, to be almost playful about this, I think there are ample biblical texts that say just that.
I think all this relates to a question that I wanted to ask you from the beginning. And then I was thinking about it when you were talking about, you know, that, of course, a God of love should be angry when what that God wants people to do isn't done in terms of love. And I was thinking about, you know, whether in some of those canonical texts, what God is angry about is usually the failure to love, or God is angry about something else, you know, like the failure to worship only God or whatever it might be. And I feel like it's both, you know, but that leads me to the question of what is the evidence, not necessarily the scientific evidence, but what is the sort of evidence in your own experience that leads you to take this position for which, you know, there really isn't evidence in the way that we usually talk about evidence?
I think that you're right, Dan, and you're actually pointing to a weakness, it seems to me, in a lot of theological writing about the God of the Bible. I think that many thinkers, understandably, conflate a kind of apologetic impulse with a commitment to reading the text in front of them. What I mean by an apologetic impulse is the desire to make the Bible as palatable and as acceptable morally and otherwise to a modern reader. Heschel talks a lot about how what God is angry at is the oppression of the widow and the orphan. But what ends up getting elided often, I think, in Heschel's writing is that God is also an angry lover who doesn't like being spurned for other lovers. Now, what many biblical scholars will say is, yes, that's true. However, part of that is because the Bible's assumption is that if you worship other gods, those gods are inextricably bound up with immorality. And yet, I'm not sure that fully answers the question. And I will mention, I think this is actually kind of just a fascinating historical point. A variety of biblical scholars have argued in the last generation that for this kind of argument, the book of Ezekiel is the biggest problem, because Ezekiel presents a God who is extremely concerned with God's own reputation. I think it's striking that in Heschel's book on the prophets, the only prophet who doesn't get a chapter of his own is Ezekiel. So I think that the apologetic impulse is understandable, but it's also important that it be critiqued, and not just critiqued by people who are not theists, but also critiqued by people who are theists, so that we can be more honest about what we're saying. You know, I think there's an impulse, you find this in some Jewish thinkers today, who have philosophical leanings, but at the end of the day, will always reach an apologetic conclusion, such that Judaism has the correct answer for whatever human problem ails us. There are days when I wish I could end up in that place as often as they do. It doesn't feel real to me. It's not who I am. What I do as a theologian is try to describe what the world looks like when you look at it through a particular lens. And I effectively say to the reader, if you find this lens or some aspect of this lens compelling, you're totally welcome to it. But I am aware that I can't offer you a set of systematic arguments at the conclusion of which you will have no choice but to see the world the way I do. I don't find them compelling as arguments, let alone, you know, do I not assume that you will. Right? So it's really about, goes back to what I was saying before about sharing intuitions. I'm essentially trying to say, try these on. And if you find them compelling, great, they're yours. Now, that relates to something you asked me, Dan, on this very podcast 2 years ago. You asked me how I feel about non-believers finding some of what I write about Torah compelling, even though they don't really know what to do with my God language. You know, and my answer to that then and now is some version of, I don't think that particular adaptation of my lens will ever be mine, but I am nowhere metaphysically, epistemologically, whatever word you want to use, you're confident enough to presume that I can prescribe what are the ways that you are entitled or not entitled to read and understand Torah. When I present my lens to someone, I am not saying to them, take it or leave it. I'm saying to them, see what the world looks like. There are certain angles of vision here that you might find helpful within your own worldview. I would hope that in all the years that we've been talking again, despite how different our way of perceiving the world is, there are things that I've said that have affected the way you understand the world and vice versa. So when you say, what evidence do I believe based on? So here's the best answer I can give you. You know, a few years ago, a prominent conservative rabbi, right, a kind of person on the right wing of the conservative movement said to me, you know, what I would really like you to do is to use your philosophical tools to make an argument to show why all Jews are obligated to keep halakha. And I said, I got to tell you, like, with great respect and admiration, I kind of feel like, from my perspective, it's a bit of a non-starter. I can tell them why I feel bound to keep it. I can share with them a variety of lenses for how other Jews have thought about why they should keep it. I'd also be happy to share with them what I think the weakness of each of those approaches is. But ultimately, I can't make that argument. Here's what I can do. I can invite them into the experience of an observant life and say, if you feel the magic here that I do, sometimes, not all the time, great. If you don't, the worst we've done is that you've understood something very powerful and constitutive of the Jewish experience. I can't say to you, I've experienced God, therefore you should believe in God. What I can say is, I've experienced God, therefore I do.
How do you imagine that one would come to this or that point of view about who God is and what God is if they didn't necessarily start from a place of belief, you know? And I'm just thinking in terms of our listeners and saying, you know, I don't know. I mean, it seems that I don't see a lot of evidence one way or the other. And, you know, and I guess I tend to have the null hypothesis therefore and say, you know, I guess they're probably, let's start by saying there isn't. So now let's think about the evidence that there is. And, you know, I think that that's actually a reversal of perhaps the human condition for much of history, where we didn't start with a null hypothesis. We started with a hypothesis that there is a God or there are gods. And, you know, we sort of went in the direction of proving the contrary, which actually, I think Judaism famously, you know, is one of those, right? Essentially, Judaism is saying, you say there are gods, and we're saying there is a God. So there, it's a form of atheism, right? I mean, right in that. So I guess what I'm struggling with here is, like, you know, well, and maybe this goes back to the pragmatist question that you I think rightly framed, which is, you know, and I talked to Art Green a little bit about this before, but I want to combine that with something that I've really learned from you and really internalized from you, which is that when you speak about the idea of walking in God's ways, that's very powerful to me, because when I think about God, I think about God as a character that human beings created to exhibit their highest aspirations. And when I think that we've arrived at a place where we can say there isn't a God, at least not in that external entity that we might have thought about it before, I think it's very important to retain the idea of walking in the ways of that God who we talked about when we framed our highest aspirations that way. And now we can frame our highest aspirations more directly, but it's still helpful to have all of that cultural heritage where we can look back and say, we've been begging God to be a certain way all along. Now it turns out we actually created a great record of how we should be. And you call that walking in God's ways, and maybe you're meaning that more literally to some extent. And I'm saying it's still enormously powerful for me. What's not powerful for me is why I should go and spend 3 hours on a Shabbat morning praying to that God, asking that God for things. To me, that feels actually like the opposite of helpful. That feels to me like I'm spending those 3 hours asking someone else to do something where I could have spent that 3 hours doing for myself or doing for others, better yet. And so what I really struggle with in terms of the pragmatism of it is, if I am thinking about whether to believe or how to believe in God based to some extent on what I think the result of that belief or non-belief is going to be on my life or on the world, then it really, really matters. And that's why I'm saying, when we think about different ways that we might think about God, what is the reason why one might adopt your point of view, both in terms of their own personal experience and how that might lead them to adopt that? Because if God is a certain way, then God is a certain way, and it doesn't matter what we believe. So if you're right, you know, then there should be a way to get there, you know, and if you're not right, or if we can't know, which is probably the more likely situation, you know, how do we sort of, how do we go on from there, right? And how do we sort of try to have a Judaism that's a value when we're going to have a lot of different points of view on that? And frankly, yours is probably going to be in the minority. And so then how do we sort of create something together?
On the days when I still believe, one of the things that makes me still believe is that I have not yet found a non-theistic story in which I truly recognize myself. Any believer who is even minimally thoughtful ought to struggle with what are the implications of really understanding that belief in God and moral goodness do not correlate necessarily and sometimes do not even correlate at all. Right? In other words, we kind of accept that as a truism in our time, and we sometimes even don't even realize what a massive revolution that is. Because I think if you ask the average religious person in the year 1600, they would say that the fact that someone is not a believer or is a heretic, it probably also means that they're morally dissolute. And if anything, you know, we see it as almost self-evident that those two things don't go together. That may be empirically true, but for the religious person, that should be a devastating truth. Because if you can say to me that Dan Liebenton does not believe in God or does not believe in, you know, a traditional notion of God, but is committed to living his life oriented around principles of love and justice. And Osama bin Laden, that's perhaps too caricature an example, but it's worth saying, right? Osama bin Laden does believe in God. And look what a monster he was. So that should, you know, give us pause. And if Osama bin Laden is not a helpful example, we can just say, we all know people who say, I'm not a believer, but we see with our own eyes that their lives are oriented around love and justice and goodness. And we see other people who say, my life is about being religious and who are horrible to other people. But the fact that there's no clear one-to-one correlation between professing religion and being a good person, let alone a person driven by love, right? That is enormously troubling. That to me, I'll just, you know, speak very personally. When I think every day about why I do what I do, right? Why am I in the business of perpetuating organized religion? That's the biggest challenge to me. But it also perhaps explains why it is so important to me to say, I'm not just in the business of perpetuating organized religion. I'm in the business of fighting on behalf of a particular vision of organized religion. Or to put it differently, I'm no longer very interested in people's answer to the question of, do you believe in God? Because the more interesting question to me, if you believe in God, is what kind of God do you believe in? And what consequences does that belief yield? And to the extent that I know people, I meet people, I encounter people who are, you know, moral beacons who don't believe in God, I'm humbled in front of them. The last impulse I have is to convert them. I want to learn from them. But I also have to confess as a believer that it also breaks my heart a bit in that it, I think, expresses the colossal failure of the history of religion, which had it been played out the way, you know, most religious thinkers worth their salt would have wanted, you would have been able to say, oh, that person's religious. Their life is totally centered on other people. Would that it were true. So I hear you. I will tell you that one question I have in a more kind of explicitly theological mode is that some Catholic writers in the present argue that it's only logical that someone who visits patients in the hospital regularly because they are trying to imitate Christ, and someone who visits patients in the hospital regularly because they think it's the right thing to do and they've cultivated a life of care, that there should be something different about the way those two people pay their visits. I find that idea very interesting, and I don't really feel empirically I've ever seen any reason to believe that. And that just leaves me where I am, which is, you know, at the end of the day, I have more questions than I have answers about all of these things.
There's part of me that wants to say, actually, that religious believers of the past can claim a lot of good and also have to take responsibility for a lot of bad. I mean, for sure. But the part where I don't sort of like the approaches of folks who sort of reject God and religion completely, right? I mean, there's a difference between being an atheist and being a Epicurus, a heretic, or whatever. You know, like there's differences in, there's one thing to say that God, as we've talked about it in the past, is not the God that I believe in. And at the same time, to be able to recognize the great work that was done in the name of God and to have an aspiration to hold on to that work in a new way. And that's what I feel like I'm trying to do. And that's why I want to give credit to believers in the present and in the past. And I don't want to leave that only in the realm of religion and belief. The other question, though, that I struggle with a lot, and I think it actually makes sense whether you're a believer or a non-believer, it's like, what is the value of prayer? You know, what is the value of prayer as being such an emphasized part of religious practice that so much time is spent on it? It's like, we just went through the high holiday period, and it's like, you know, I just started thinking, like, what was happening there? You know, and I understand that there's a lot of things that could be good that are happening there in addition to the praying and the worshiping to God. But I guess I'm still asking, like, what are we doing when we're talking to God in that context?
So let me say something about the first part of your question and then come to the question that you ended with. It's interesting to me, and it's not surprising given your own beliefs, that you tend to speak about the good that religion or belief in God did. And then you correct yourself and end up saying, and in the present too. It's like very interesting. It's a very interesting window into your own thinking. And I feel the need to say, and more almost for a kind of intellectual honesty perspective, that it's the good that religion did and does, right? Because I don't think we should underestimate the extent to which belief in God leads to, you know, unimaginable acts of kindness. And to go to your point about, you know, the difference between an atheist and a heretic. So I'll say that, you know, one of the things that for me is most kind of off-putting about a certain style of contemporary atheism is that it leads to almost unhinged hatred of religion in ways that cause a totally skewed vision of the world. I'll give you a very concrete example because I think it's actually quite relevant to what we're talking about. Steven Weinberg, who's a Nobel Prize winning physicist, said many years ago in the pages of the New York Review of Books, and he loves the fact that he says this. He quotes himself about it all the time, right? He said, "For good people to do good things is easy. For bad people to do bad things is also easy. But in order to get good people to do unimaginably bad things, for that we need religion." Now, I read that line and I thought, now that's really clever. But you know, it's only intellectually honest if you'll also say that in order to get really bad people to do incredibly good things, for that we also often need religion, right? Because, and now this is my language here, religion is at the end of the day an amplifier. It takes what it finds and it amplifies it. Which is why what Weinberg says is so unhelpful, because I think actually what we need to think about is, given that religion is an amplifier, how can we make it amplify the good? How can we make it amplify love rather than hate? How can we make it amplify our sense of who we're responsible to and for rather than constricting it? You know, those are the really interesting questions. But becoming fundamentalist about our irreligion is not that much more helpful than becoming fundamentalist about our religion. Now, regarding the prayer question, you know, I was struck, Dan, by what you said. What are we doing when we say those words? So one of the things that I want to say is perhaps obvious, which is it may very well be that you and I are not doing the same thing when we say those words. And one of the implications of that may be that many Jews going forward, even Jews who I hope will become more committed to being more knowledgeable and learned and more literate in their tradition, will not pray in a way that you and I would recognize as prayer from our childhoods. And I don't actually have a problem with that if it comes from a place of substance and commitment and a kind of clarity about why we're doing what we're doing. I don't know how long many American Jews will continue doing something that is for them vestigial. I will also say, given that the personal God I believe in is not micromanaging the world in any way, I also struggle a lot with what exactly are we doing when we use petitionary language. Oh God, please this, please that. I have many thoughts about that, but I can't say that any of them are fully compelling to me, which is yet another reason for me to be a little more humble in you know, interacting with people who say, why am I, this language does not work for me in any real way. Now, I think I'll just say, this is perhaps a discussion for another episode of your podcast. One of the challenges is, can we create communities that are Judaically deep, that have Jewish language in a real way, that play with alternative forms of worship or non-worship or meditation or whatever you want to say? But that's, I think, just a, you know, a question I think we all have to wrestle with. Now, you said something in passing that I did want to mention, I did want to engage with at least briefly. I am always conscious of the ways in which I think in contemporary Jewish discourse, I am a minority voice in two ways. One is that we live in an atheological time in the Jewish community. That is not the same thing as an atheistic time, although the two correlate to some degree, right? Very few people talk about God. And to the extent that they do, they certainly don't do it in some way that is, you know, philosophical or theological. And so someone like me who I don't experience myself as having chosen. I never decided one day I'm going to spend my life thinking about God and helping other people have language for doing that. It's just what my heart felt compelled to do. It's kind of like, that's just sort of what happened to me in some way. The things that work for me, I have no illusions that we're living in a time when a majority of Jews are going to end up there. Do I think that 70% of the world is going to become a halachic egalitarian Jew? No, I don't think that. Do I think that 5-10% could plausibly? Yeah, sure. But, you know, so, but you know, similarly about God. And I'm doubly a minority in that when I talk about God, in the Jewish community at least, I'm talking about God in a way that many people who have grown more interested in talking about God in recent years don't want to or don't feel able to talk.
I think what you said about not finding yourself in a non-theistic story is just a really important point for a number of reasons. Because if part of the goal or the human enterprise is to find something that resembles ourselves, find something that we can see ourselves in, then an anthropomorphic God, by definition, is more likely to fit that role. A God that sort of has human qualities, that does human verbs in some form or another. And once again, I appreciate what you said. I don't want to strawman your argument, but some form of personal God will resemble that more than a God that is as abstract as saying everything is God, to steal the Jay Michelson book title. Because seeing oneself in that, as much as I'm a part of everything, like, so is everything. So it's not that helpful. But I bring that up to say, like, given that a personal God does speak to you and that you have found yourself in the story whereby God is a personal God, how does that function? And I'm actually thinking back to what you said about lenses. I had an eye appointment recently, so I'm thinking about like literal eye lenses, and like I got new glasses. And I'm thinking, so what does that lens of anthropomorphism of, and once again, I'm not saying it's absolute that God is a person like us, but what does the idea of God as a personal figure, what does it do for you?
You asked the question of what does a personal God do for me? Now, religiously, I'll just say I'm resistant to that language because I think one of the main things religion is in the world to do, to get us to overcome the impulse to ask about everything, what can it do for me? I realize you don't mean it that way, but I think it's important to say that one of the main things religion in the world to do is to reframe our questions from what can this do to me, for me, to what can I do for values and principles and ideals that are greater than myself? How can I serve? That said, what is it about belief in a personal God that compels me? Which is the way I would prefer to frame your question without violating the question, I think. Part of it is that I am trying to make sense of certain intuitions that are really primary for me and that are basic to my experience of the world. For example, something I've been wrestling with the last few years, and I would underscore here again, this is not an argument, not by a long shot. It is merely an intuition. And I've written about this a little bit and hope to be writing about it more. It's what I would call the intuition from protest. When a parent grieves for the death, for the untimely death of their child, and people show up to Shiva and say, as they often do, The world is not supposed to be like that. I find myself wondering often, what do they mean by that? What do you mean the world is not supposed to look like that? The world has always looked like that. And until the modern period, the world looked like that overwhelmingly. People buried kids after kids after kids after kids. So when you say the world is not supposed to be like that, what are you really saying? And I've come to think that part of it is an intuition of transcendence. This is related to an argument that the sociologist Peter Berger made, that there are things about human life that are what he calls signals of transcendence, things that we say and do and feel that are sort of very hard to understand within a purely secular understanding of who and what we are. When I say the world is not supposed to be overrun by brutal dictators, I am really not saying just, I don't like that the world is overrun by brutal dictators. I am somehow expressing an intuition that there is some way the world is supposed to be in light of which I measure the reality that I inhabit. There is some transcendent truth in light of which this world ought to be evaluated. To me, that opens the door to some notion of a transcendent God in light of which the world can be measured. Now, that is not, to go back to something Dan said earlier, that is not, and is not even near, an argument for a God of revelation or for the divinity of the Torah or anything like that. What it is an intuition of goodness that is greater than human. But I don't say I don't like when hurricanes kill people. I say it shouldn't be this way. And what am I tapping into in saying that? Peter Berger gives the example, the sociologist I mentioned, gives the example of how it is that all over the world, mothers almost instinctively pick up a crying child and say, it's going to be okay. It's not, you could get hit by a bus tomorrow, and so could I. You could be orphaned tomorrow. You could be abused. You could be assaulted. We could all die of starvation. It's not, I don't know that it's going to be okay. And yet when I say it, I believe it in some really profound way. What I am saying in an extremely long-winded way is that I have certain intuitions about the world that make most sense to me if I understand the world as having been brought into being by someone with a purpose. One of my primary experiences in life is of being commanded. Now, I'll be honest and say, I don't often feel commanded about very many ritual things, although I sometimes do, but I feel genuinely commanded by certain interpersonal obligations. And by commanded, I mean, it feels to me like they are coming from some other place than just either my own desires or even the face of the person in front of me. It seems to me that they reflect some truth about the world. That is all makes more sense to me in thinking about a God who's personal. God is other than me, right? Someone to whom I can relate, but not me.
One thing I've really appreciated in this conversation, I've appreciated so many things, both in what in the actual content of what you're saying, but also in the manner in which the way you're recognizing even in how Dan and I ask questions and what's like lurking beneath the surface of certain words and phrases, you're helping like unlock deeper ways of how we think. I think that's really special. But I also think that you've named at a variety of moments weaknesses of your own ideas or of others' ideas, and given both sides of that. And so I thought I'd try and mirror that a little bit, because I do in many ways advocate for maybe not an entirely atheological, but a less theological Jewish world. I've said things like I think God, because we spoke with Danielle Hartman about putting God second. I've said in the past, you know, maybe God's seventh or eighth for me. Like, I'm not even sure if God's second for me. I do have a theology. But the weakness in what I'm saying and in that worldview is that I do think there's a passion that often accompanies deep God belief, and it can accompany a personal God belief, and it can even accompany a deep panentheist God belief. It's not unique to any one theology, but those who have God belief, I think, really do feel, I mean, you used the word commanded before, they feel this obligation in a sense that those of us who are less sure or less deeply entrenched don't always have. And, you know, I do have many passions of my own, but I don't know how to trace them. I have to sort of psychoanalyze myself to try and get to them. But I think there are some people who I'm jealous of, for whom many of their passions really are, you know, I believe that God commands me to do X. And so I really step up and I do it. And that can be in ways that are abhorrent to me on the conservative end. It can be in wonderful ways on a more progressive end, but it's there. And so I guess I just sort of really love, as we close, to hear from you, like, you speak with passion and your God belief matters to you. And it has implications for your politics and for how you act on a day-to-day basis. Because you're so good at analyzing why that might be, what is happening in God belief that does a better job of provoking that than those of us who are not so entrenched in any particular theology?
My initial kind of gut reaction to your question, which I really need to think about, it's a very interesting formulation, is that I think there are people who are non-believers who have a particular moral vision of the world that they believe so uninhibitedly and unreservedly is the truth that they are abundantly motivated to live up to it. I think one of the things that keeps many of us from being able to do that is that we hold many of our beliefs only half-heartedly. Or if half-heartedly is not the right word, we are all too consciously aware all the time of the ways that, oh, well, I might be wrong. And as much as I have found ways in my own life to make doubt, I think, salutary, it has costs. And some of the costs are ambivalence can be paralyzing. Many believers are deeply unambivalent, and that is enormously motivating. Many non-believers are ambivalent about what they believe and don't believe, and maybe find it harder to find the kind of unequivocal motivating force because of that. When someone takes religious commitment seriously, it becomes almost an engine of doing in their life. And I don't think that engine is all that easily replaceable. I don't think it's irreplaceable, but I'm not sure how many of us end up managing to replace it. And that's a loss. To the extent that, you know, irreligion or non-belief are and are going to be widespread, that's a real loss.
Thank you so much for joining us. This has been a fantastic conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thanks, of course, also to all of you out there listening. We hope you've enjoyed this episode, and we want to close it out in the same way we always do, by encouraging you to be in touch with us. And there are a few ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can go to our Twitter feed at Judaism Unbound. Third, you can go to our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can hit us up via email at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. We also wanted to let you know that right now, we've got a big forward-looking, future-looking, future-oriented survey out that is going to play a huge role in helping us figure out what our plans are moving forward with Judaism Unbound. And we really, really want to hear from all of you out there. So wherever you are, whoever you are, whatever you think of us, we would love to hear from you so that you can help shape the future of Judaism Unbound programming. And you can find that survey on our website at judaismunbound.com/survey. We hope that you will check it out and fill it out. That's really the key part. So once again, that's judaismunbound.com/survey. We make lots of asks. This one's a biggie. judaismunbound.com/survey. The last request that we always make is that, of course, you can support us financially. And there are a few ways that you can do that, each of which are accessible at judaismunbound.com/donate. So thanks so much for listening. We hope that you've enjoyed this episode. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.